Hello and welcome to Travels Through Time, the podcast made in partnership with Jordan Lloyd and Colourgraph. I'm Peter Moore. Today we're heading back to the Dutch Golden Age, a time poised between the medieval and modern worlds, to unravel the mysteries of the planets, to square up to the problem of pendulum motion, and to meet a forgotten star of the history of science. In the 1650s, news of a brilliant young thinker began to circulate throughout the cities and universities of Europe. Still in his 20s, Christian Huygens had acquired the name the Dutch Archimedes for his precocious talents. Soon, as the writer Hugh Aldersey Williams explains in his new biography of Huygens, he was being acclaimed as the greatest mathematician, astronomer, and physicist of the age. Huygens was perhaps the most celebrated figure to live in the period between Galileo and Newton, but his life and his achievements have been strangely neglected in the English-speaking world over the past century. In his book Dutch Light, Aldersey Williams tells Christian's whole fascinating story afresh, explaining his discoveries in astronomy, mechanics, and light. Golden Light is not just a biography of a man, but a portrait of an age. It takes us back to a time of Dutch magic, from Rembrandt's art to the discovery of new technologies like the telescope. I asked Hugh to take us back to a year at the very heart of this story. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
It's a real pleasure to have you on Travels Through Time. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
I thought I'd start this discussion, which is going to be centered around your book, Dutch Light, which looks at the life of Christian Huygens. Am I pronouncing that reasonably?
Yeah. Brief me if you like. There are so many answers to this now. English people normally say Huygens, which is Dutch people say Huygens, which you can understand not everyone wants to follow along with. And I had a French physics teacher once, and he called him Huygens.
So he's an enigma in the beginning with his
I think it's going to say Huygens.
Let's go with Huygens, okay, which is about Christian Huygens. And I just thought I'd start really where you start the book, with this wonderful picture, not of him, but of the age that he is a part of, when there's a sand yacht skimming over the dunes, and it's a real symbol of the time. I thought you could tell me a little bit about that anecdote that you begin your book with.
Yes, this is quite a lot earlier than Christian Huygens gets on the scene. The sand yacht was a creation of an important forerunner of Huygens and of lots of other later innovators in Holland and elsewhere. It was a chariot on four wheels, it seems, with a very large sail, a bit like a sort of Viking ship, and a standard that flew at the top of the mast. And you could seat quite a few people on it. And it supposedly bowled along the beach at Scheveningen, which is just on the North Sea coast near The Hague, at alarming speeds, basically faster than anything people would have seen go at that time, or any manpower thing, faster than a horse pulling anything.
And in doing so, it becomes a really nice metaphor of the Dutch Golden Age, or the early part of it at least, which is really a century or so from the 1580s to the 1670s. I'm sure we could date it more precisely. Even though I said that this book is essentially a biography of Christian, there's so much in the early part about his father, Constantine. Mm-hmm. And in a way, it struck me that it is kind of like a family biography in a way, because you see the web of connections between the father, the mother, and I think there's the boys and the sister. So yeah. Four boys or three?
There are four boys in all, including Christian and a sister.
Exactly, and he's the lead character, and he emerges as this genius. But really, you show it to be a family biography, and I thought that in that case, we should talk a little bit about the patriarch of this family, Constantine.
So he is a diplomat for the House of Orange. He works for Prince Frederick Hendrik and later on for his successors. As a diplomat, he travels reasonably far and wide. He comes to England several times in the around 1620 and another time too. He was knighted by King James, in fact. He also was knighted by Louis XIV, so he was very kind of highly regarded in the foreign centres he visited on his diplomatic missions. And he sort of enlisted the family into this trade as well, so that the brothers were later to go on diplomatic missions themselves here and there, more or less on their father's instructions. At their father's behest, the family operated as a sort of team. The brothers were off here and there.
Yeah, I'll quote you back to yourself here, actually. You say their diplomat father no doubt saw the brothers' advent in Paris as the last thread in his Europe-wide family web, which is quite a nice, interesting way to characterise it. And of course, this is the father who a generation before had met Sir Francis Bacon. He'd been knighted by the king. He'd helped the career of the young Rembrandt. They're so close to all these characters that we know a little bit about. Could you say something about the correspondence between the family members? Because presumably they wrote lots of letters to each other, and how much of these letters, or how much of this correspondence survives, and where can you find it? And did you find it?
There is a lot of correspondence. Constantine Huygens, the father, is said to have written 50,000 letters or something like that, which is a huge number. Pushing six figures of letters, because he's a diplomat. You know, often these are little tiny letters that have to be folded up very secretly and locked and sealed and so on and sent off the battlefield. He's often out on the battlefield during the with Frederick Hendrik or William II in Holland during the war, and has to communicate. From there, he's a man of court, so he writes in French, and the whole family does this. Constantine's letters are gathered in a multi-volume collected set that was conveniently available for me at a library and is all online because the Dutch have digitized all this rather fantastically.
Oh, we'll have to include a bit of a link on our website. So that sounds like a fascinating resource. Yeah.
And then Christian, as I said, he wrote in French too, mostly, and his correspondence is mostly preserved at the University of Leiden.
Okay, so let's get to Christian, who is the heart of this conversation, the heart of your book, and what a character as well. He was born in April 1629, the second son, I think, and he was...
The first son is called Constantine as well, which is why you have to be a bit careful with which Constantine.
It's confusing for biographers, I imagine, when you have to navigate these names. Yeah. But yeah, into this like kind of big family and a big house with a big reputation, I suppose we could say. And there are hopes for him, and he, as a young boy, shows these streaks of genius. He's known at University of Leiden, where he goes to as a young Archimedes, isn't he?
Yes, well, his father, Marimassen, who first calls him the Dutch Archimedes, and then his father loves this and sort of seizes it on it and proudly repeats it to everyone he can tell, I think. He has great mathematical and geometrical ability, and hence the Archimedes name, and also promise in mechanics and making devices that do things. And he's often kind of chided by his tutors for making these contraptions that, you know, they do things, but then they'll break. And they're seen as a distraction from the, you know, the proper learning of, you know, the trivium and quadrivium that they were schooled in, and the logic and the rhetoric and the astronomy and the music and so on. So making devices was a bit déclassé and seen as a distraction from what he should be doing. But it becomes very much part of who he is professionally later on.
Well, before we dive into the detail, I thought I've got your book right here in front of me, and I thought I'd read something that you write at the very beginning, which is a good way of framing his importance. And you say, Christian Huygens was Europe's greatest scientist during the latter half of the 17th century until the rise of Isaac Newton, by whom he has been largely eclipsed. That's a lovely, lovely term, especially in the English-speaking parts of the world. This is an unfair judgment of the history of science, for his achievement exceeds that of Newton in some important respects. Before we get into the detail, could you just give us a bit of an overview for people who maybe aren't familiar, as people in the English-speaking part of the world perhaps, who aren't familiar with him, and then we'll go look at him in more closer range.
Huygens lives, essentially, in terms of physics and astronomy and mathematics, between Galileo and Newton. And people know what Galileo did, and they know some of the sort of myths and stories around his life as well. And people know what Newton did, because it has lasted and still matters to us in very sort of fundamental eternal physics. But people mostly don't know much about Huygens, who, you know, occupied this substantial period between the two men and was definitely the most fated man in their fields in that period. So Newton wasn't really a major figure until the beginning of the 1700s. He didn't circulate much, and he was a difficult figure. And the myth of Newton came along later and was built largely by others abroad in France, and Voltaire and stuff, and bigged him up. That served, as I say, to eclipse Huygens' achievements, which were, yes, lesser in some respects, because Newton's achievements were enormous. But on the other hand, Huygens got certain things right that Newton didn't have anything to say about.
Maybe we can pick up on those at the end. But now, well, you've given us that overview. Let's go and meet him at a specific point in his life. If you could go back and see Huygens at a particular moment in a particular year, what year would you like to choose?
Okay, well, I'm choosing the 25th of March, 1655.
Okay, so we're going to go for the year 1655. Just before we get into what was happening on the 25th of March, is there anything you'd like to say about this particular year in a contextual sense? What's going on?
The 80 Years' War, which is this huge, long-lasting war between Spain and the Dutch provinces and involving other powers from time to time, is finally over. That finished in 1648. The people who've ruled Holland were the House of Orange, as I mentioned earlier, Prince Frederick Hendrik and his successor. But they leave the scene in 1650, and there's this two-decade period called the Stadtholderless period. We suddenly have this thing called the Stadtholderless period, when there is no House of Orange leader, and the country becomes more of a republic. It's then led by a man called Johan de Witt, who is there from 1653 to 1672, and it's the height of the prosperity of the Dutch Republic. At sea, it's very powerful. Trade is enormous, exotic trades and so on, in all sorts of things, and the painting and the art and so on of all sorts is at its peak.
Yeah, there's a nice little passage you put in the book looking at the Netherlands through English eyes. It's I think a poem by Andrew Marvell, is that right? And he's looking at this watery little island, which is a mix of different religions and different languages. And yet it seems, despite being a Tower of Babel, that it kind of makes sense. So 25th of March, you said before, we're going to take this for your first scene, because we're going to go through this year in three scenes. This is the first.
Yeah.
Could you describe what's happening on this day?
So it must be the night of the 25th of March, because Huygens is out in the garden of the family house, which is a very grand house that stood right next to the Maritz House in The Hague. The Maritz House is now a museum that has a lot of fabulous artwork from this period, including some pictures of the Huygens family. And Huygens's house was, if anything, slightly grander than that, and stood more or less next door. And it had a long garden that ran between the two houses. And so in this garden, Christian sets up his 12-foot telescope that magnifies about 50 times, and he's built that himself with his brother, his older brother, Constantine. The two of them spend a lot of time at various stages in their lives making ever better and often longer telescopes, and they grind the lenses themselves as well. And that's a very arduous, obviously a very vital task, but very arduous, taxing, be ultra patient, and obviously the results have to be pretty perfect to work at all well. So they've ground their lenses and they've incorporated them into this 12-foot telescope. They've pointed it up at Saturn. And Saturn has become the sort of go-to planet for astronomers. After Galileo in 1610 has discovered the four moons of Jupiter, or four of the moons of Jupiter, the first four moons of Jupiter. And that has changed the solar system for the first time since the descriptions of it by ancient astronomers in Greece and so on. So suddenly things look rather different, and the sort of music of the spheres has shifted slightly. And Saturn, they can see with their suboptimal telescopes at that time, was not entirely satisfactory as a planet because it didn't have a sort of steady, crisp, circular outline. It appeared to fuzzy and change shape, and it was hard to work out what was going on.
This is the furthest planet. At that time, yes, that's right.
So Huygens looks at the planet with this improved telescope of his own making, and trying to work out what's going on with the thing, and sees, in addition to this sort of irregular, blurry outline of the planet itself, he sees a couple of little bright spots moving around it, which he labels in his notes Étoile A and Étoile B. And he studies them for a bit longer, and Etoile B eventually sort of wanders off and appears to not be behaving in any regular way and can be dismissed. And Etoile A, he discovers, has a regular orbit. He measures its period, and this is the first moon of Saturn.
Well, there's a few things to go to here. This is a huge moment in the history of science, discovering one of the moons of Saturn. I think this is the one that Herschel calls Titan. Is that right?
That's right.
A century later. So it doesn't acquire that name. But looking out to the very, very edges of space as it was at that time and seeing something, the way we think of scientific discovery is often, you know, kind of framed within this idea of a eureka moment. Was it like a moment that he realized that he discovered something completely new at that moment, or did he have to go back and check his calculations? What was his method of working?
Well, this is more observations than calculations. So by the time he'd spent a couple more months measuring the orbital period, which was 15 days or so, he was pretty confident that it was a satellite. That's what satellites do. They go around things at a regular interval. So that was pretty definite. I don't know if he actually wrote Eureka in his notes on this occasion, but he does occasionally do that when he...
Does he? That's interesting. Was he of the Newtonian persuasion, by which I mean that he might discover something and not tell people about it for 10 years afterwards? Or does he communicate quite quickly? Because, of course, if you know, in the sphere of knowledge, if you've discovered something, the next problem is, well, you've got to prove it, of course, but then you've got to circulate this knowledge to other authorities.
Well, that's right. And this is what makes this period so interesting. There aren't yet scientific journals, so it's not simply a matter of writing up a paper and submitting it to a journal. He has to communicate what he's discovered, but do it in a way that kind of can protect his ownership and priority in it. So it has to have his name on it, and it has to be dated, and it has to say what it is, but not in a way that everyone can immediately read it and take it off him. So what he does is he writes an anagram he sends to the English mathematician and cryptographer John Wallis, and he writes this anagram that when decoded, when he chooses to reveal it's a very difficult anagram. It's not like a crossword anagram. When he chooses to reveal the decoded anagram later, he can point to the original anagram's date and say, but I had this then. So can I tell you the anagram if I find it?
Can, I'm all curiosity.
So he actually is a quotation from Ovid for additional entertainment. So he wrote, ad movere oculis distantia sidera nostris. And then there are lots of leftover letters. So there's 7 V's and 3 C's and a couple of R's, H, N, B, Q, X. And then when you rearrange them, these letters come out as Saturno Luna Suad circunducitor diebus sextecim oris quatuor, which means this is a moon of Saturn that orbits in 16 days and 4 hours.
But let me, but one thing I don't want to let you get away with now is the telescopes, because obviously he is a very talented observer, but he needs the technology to help him do so. You mentioned it before in your description that over the previous few years, he had been working with his brother to grind better telescopes. Because I know, like earlier on in the book, you talk about the discovery of the telescope, or the invention of the telescope, we could talk about it, which has various claimants who actually did it. But it's very particular to this part of Holland, isn't it? This skill in grinding glass.
There's a pretty sound basis for believing that the telescope was essentially invented in the Netherlands. And that was around 1608. And I talk about some of the people who were involved in that.
And there's a great moment. I'm just going to have to interject with this. You got this display because, you know, there's this new technology and they want to show it to the people that matter. And there's one of the Spanish military leaders is there watching this new technology magnify, you know, many miles away and realizing that there was something pretty dangerous about it.
Yes, well, the ironic situation was that one of the claimant inventors of the telescope was asked to demonstrate this instrument of his in The Hague. And they climbed up the Prince Moritz Tower in the Binnenhof, which is the kind of royal palace in the middle of The Hague. And it was at a time when they were negotiating a truce in the endless war. And they were just about, there was sort of like half time. There was a break from about 1609 to 1621 in this war. And so the Spanish ambassador is there and military figures from both sides and so on, and yet they're sort of openly demonstrating this telescope that, you know, apart from being a great astronomical boon, is also clearly of great military significance. So as I said, the one in Huygens's garden in 1655 was 12 feet long, and his next telescope, which he'll use, is 23 feet long. So, I mean, imagine 12 feet long, it's not short. It's not like a sort of pocket telescope. It is an unwieldy instrument. It has to be supported on a sort of cradle of some sort. And yet Saturn moves across the sky, so you have to be able to move this telescope with it at the same time. And telescopes got longer and longer. I mean, one direction of the sort of technological thrust of telescope development was to make them longer and longer, and ultimately they get to sort of a couple of hundred feet long.
There's the Herschel ones, which get really big, I know.
Then there are reflecting telescopes, which make the whole thing a lot more manageable again. But a 200-foot telescope with lenses in line, with the objective lens 200 feet away from the eyepiece, actually becomes a whole different kind of problem. You can't, or it's no longer practical to have a tube joining those two lenses. So what you do is you put the objective lens up a mast or in a tree or something, and then you link it by some sort of rod or thread to the objective lens so you can chase it around by lining the two up with just open dark sky between the two, no encasement. You can use it that way, and that becomes that's a really tricky piece of equipment to use, as you can imagine, and you know, the slightest breeze or movement is going to make it very hard.
But which does lead me on, actually, I should mention this, because I really liked, and we should take this story forward a little bit, just because I think it's 4 years on when Huygens actually publishes his book on Saturn. And in that, there's a really nice illustration that you capture in the book, which tries to reconcile the enigma of the shape of the planet. And I think it's just like various columns and rows which show everyone's idea of what it might actually look like. And there's like squashed ones, there's elliptical ones, and there's his with the ring. Do you want to say something about that quickly before we move on?
Yes, well, this is Huygens' Systema Saturnium, which was the treatise you're referring to, was published in 1659. And this contains his news without the anagram now about Titan. And it also has the fact that he has now worked out what the extraneous blurry shapes around Saturn are. And this is the ring. And he's used that 23-foot telescope I referred to discern the ring properly. And the diagram you're talking about shows other people's proposals for what might be going on in Galileo's and Pierre Gassendi and Johannes Hevelius and various other astronomers in different countries around Europe at the time. The difficulty is that the shape changes. Even if you can discern it gradually more and more clearly through a telescope, it changes. And so some people think there are two large, close moons either side of Saturn. And then some people think there are kind of ears or jug handles attached to the planet. And none of these answers is terribly satisfactory, because why would they appear and disappear? You have to have a rationale for why they would appear to alter over periods of months and years. Huygens worked out that the form was a ring, and that the ring, because of the tilt on the ring as seen from Earth, because of the planet's orbit, because of Saturn's rotation, and actually because of the Earth as well, alters, so that sometimes the ring is edge on, and the ring being very thin basically disappears from view of a telescope of that period. And then at other periods it appears larger, appears sort of more or less the size of the planet itself, and becomes much more visible and obvious. And because Huygens is such a fine mathematician, Dutch Archimedes and so on, he understands that the answer to this conundrum has to involve symmetry in a way that is sort of plausible. So the idea of two close moons orbiting around the planet seems physically awkward, as well as not really squaring with the way the appearance of the planet changes. Whereas the ring has the circular symmetry that you'd expect of something around a planet. So he's united his mathematical intuition with what he's observed through the telescope to arrive at his answer.
Hi, I'm Artemis, one of the presenters on this podcast. At Travels Through Time, we're incredibly proud to be partnering with Jordan Lloyd, one of the world's leading visual historians. His extraordinary photo colorization work has appeared on the covers of National Geographic, Life, and People magazines, and he's worked on special projects for titles like The Times of London and NPR. Through his expertly researched and detailed work, Jordan has brought to life some of the most famous events and people from modern history. Whether it's his portrait of Abraham Lincoln or his sweeping panorama of the D-Day beaches in 1944. One of my current favourites is a photograph taken on the 1911 Terra Nova expedition to the Antarctic. The original shot is strange and beautiful, and it shows just how otherworldly parts of our planet can sometimes look. But the image is completely elevated by the deep and icy blues that Jordan's colourisation work brings out. This, alongside many others, are available to buy as prints, and they make an unusual and striking present for that friend or family member of yours who loves the past. To find your favourite historical image, have a look at Jordan's site at www.colograph.co.
If nothing else, that is a phenomenal achievement in the history of science, and that majestic picture that we all have of Saturn with its ring goes back to this moment. And maybe this is the beginning of that investigation that we're looking at now in March of 1655. But of course, that wasn't everything that he was doing. Huygens was up to other things. One of the challenges of writing the book must have been to try and get all this simultaneous work in some kind of order. But we're going to go and have a look at a second scene, which takes us away from the planets and takes us into a different realm of science. So where would you like to go to for your second scene?
So if I'm allowed, I'm going to have a flashback. So this is only 3 weeks earlier, in fact. This is on the 4th of March, 1655. And he does have funny recurrences in his dates of discoveries of things, actually. He does have lucky months. Anyway, this is it's simply a small piece of correspondence where he is in a position to recommend for a Dutch patent a clock designed by, as it happens, a Polish inventor called Johannes Placentinus. And this shows simply that Huygens is, as you say, pursuing many parallel interests at once. And chief among the parallel interests, aside from astronomy, is his work on clocks. And he will come up with his own major innovation in clocks about 18 months later, 2 years later.
Mm. Could you tell us a little bit about this idea of pendulum motion, how new it was? Because this is going to be his great contribution to the idea of clocks.
So Galileo, one of the things, the sort of semi-mythical things we know about Galileo is that he studied the swinging lamps in the church and worked out that a pendulum swings with the period governed by, in a square root relationship, with its length. So that's very useful for clockmakers, because you have a powered device that operates at a constant rate. So there were pendulum clocks from the early part of the 17th century, but they were terribly inaccurate and they'd lose minutes in an hour or gain minutes. So they needed to be improved. And at the background of all this was, of course, the wish to be able to tell time at sea. And to have a device to do that, so that if you couldn't do astronomical timekeeping and cloudy and so on, you could know how far around the Earth you were by comparing times on your clock aboard and so on.
I was interested in this, actually, because people will generally know from nothing else than Davis Abell's book on longitude that in the 18th century there was a great prize that was offered for solving this, and eventually Harrison, the watchmaker, came up with his various timepieces, which you can go and see today. That's in Greenwich, and they're wonderful things. But I wasn't aware quite how deep this history went, because you're talking about prizes being offered by King Philip II of Spain in the 1560s, and then there was another prize offered by the Dutch in the 17th century. So this is a more stubborn history than I think I appreciate.
Yes, I mean, it's a desideratum for a very long time. So I think people, you know, in a position to offer rewards have been doing that. And I wouldn't be surprised if there were others in other countries. I don't know what incentives there were actually in England before the sort of famous prize of the 18th century that wasn't quite awarded to Harrison. So it is something that people want to solve, and a sort of a mechanical clock is much to be desired.
And does it link together as well with the fact that there were Dutch merchant ships going far out into the east, and if anything could be done to improve their navigation?
Well, obviously, as a major maritime power, the Dutch were more interested than most. And, you know, I suppose the incentive to solve the problem rises and falls as your maritime strength changes. And so Spain was a strong maritime power in the 16th century, and the Dutch were in the 17th, and England, Britain was in the 18th. So that's an interesting way to sort of track that, who's offering the prizes.
I'm just thinking if we should take this story from this moment forward a little bit, because it's quite interesting to know how much of an advance Huygens makes with this problem.
Okay, this is where it gets a bit technical. The pendulum of a fixed length swings at a constant rate, so can be used as a regulating mechanism in a clock. You've got a slight problem, because if the swing is too great, actually the period of the swing becomes longer. So what you want to do is to control the amount of swing of the pendulum. But the clock's going to run down, so gradually, obviously, the pendulum swing is going to get less and less. So what you want is a compensating mechanism that allows the pendulum swing when it's at its maximum to not become elongated. When it swings a little, that small angle of displacement, that's very useful. When the swing becomes too great, it becomes distorted and irregular and less reliable for timekeeping. So Huygens wanted to devise a little gizmo to regularize the swing at the extremes so that the pendulum would run down and be accurate at all stages of its running down. And what he discovered could do this were certain little sort of, I'm not sure quite what you call them. He calls them cheeks in his writing. It's a sort of curved metal plate that bulges slightly into the path of the thread of the pendulum at the top. And this has the effect that when the swing gets too great, the thread bears on this bulging metal plate and in effect accelerates the swing back and shortens the period of the swing by altering the path of the pendulum bob at the bottom very slightly. So eventually he arrives at an optimal shape, and this modified pendulum clock, he then instructs this clockmaker in The Hague to build for him. And this later becomes a tricky relationship because the clockmaker takes the innovation sort of for his own.
Well, we'll have to leave that one. But it's fascinating to think of this. I mean, clocks and the watchmaker are so often used as metaphors of this time as the enlightenment of the scientific revolution. And here you're kind of giving us this picture of him, you know, embroiled in the problem of timekeeping and how it's going to regulate the world in a much better, precise, neat way. It's really attractive as a scene to think about him with this Polish inventor's clock and his own mind ticking along at the same time.
His mind is on astronomy and he's interested in an accurate clock. So you can measure accurately, for example, the period of rotation of Saturn's moon or the transit of something across the sun. So that's the astronomer's incentive for wanting an accurate clock. And it may well be that Huygens' clockmakers, and this one is called Samuel Costa in The Hague, has a completely different sort of market in mind. I mean, he's not interested in astronomy at all. He's interested in wealthy clients who believe it's important to tell the time accurately, which is a sort of arguable need at that period anyway. So there are these sort of different motivations and tensions involved in the field, as well as it being this quite fast-moving tech field. I mean, it's still fast-moving in the sense that if you're working on a single clock, trying to improve it, you can make these changes fairly quickly and progress. And it's fast-moving also in the sense that there are competitors and there are people who will be able to make the clock as good as yours almost immediately.
Well, let's move on to your third scene, which is a little bit later on in 1655. Where would you like to go to next?
So this is 4 months later in 1655 now, 23rd of July. And this is when Christian arrives in Paris for the first time. He's only had one short trip abroad. He'd been to Denmark and Holstein, but now he's off to Paris. And, you know, 4 months ago, he discovered the first moon of Saturn. So he has that calling card. And can I just perhaps read his first impressions?
Please do. Is this the letter?
Yes. So yeah. He's arrived in Paris. He's been there for 9 days and he's writing home dutifully, as he always does. I have as yet hardly been out to find people of letters or music, and I'm just running about the streets with the two others of my companions. We went together to Ambassador Borel's, who holds forth with seriousness. Afterwards at Monsieur Brasset's, and we also saw Mademoiselle, his daughter, whom I found highly knowledgeable about everything, even the least that happens in Holland, and the rest, who were a little less beautiful than in the past, but nevertheless in very good humour as always. We have only been to the Cour once, and once to the Comédie, which is hardly any more fine than that of His Highness at The Hague, and costs an écu per head. Everything is expensive here, but mainly I foresee that we shall incur pretty costs in carriages. I have accommodation on my own in a room that is mostly carpeted. There is an attic above where the rats and mice often come to keep me company. Apart from that, the bugs bother me at night so much that I carry the marks on my hands and forehead. Perhaps you would hardly wish to be in my place. That's to his older brother, who's been to Paris before.
And Paris, well, there's two parts of this. There's Huygens, who we are getting a bit of a sense now of, and Paris, which we should spend a little bit of time describing, because this was to become one of the great centres for scientific innovation over the century to come. Is that right?
Certainly was, yes. I perhaps hadn't quite sort of kicked off yet. At the time when Huygens arrives there in 1655, there are lots of salons of sort of learned people discoursing on this, that and the other. But nothing, I mean, as everywhere else, nothing very organised about how science is done and how scientists talk to other scientists and so on.
And there's this well-known quote that you, of course, include at the start of your book from Huygens, which is, "The world is my country, science my religion," which is a wonderful aspiration for science breaking down these national boundaries and getting beyond the petty rivalries of small nations in the greater quest for knowledge. Is this even the start of this coming through at this moment with him, or does he align himself very much with the French scientists?
I think that sense of being involved in a sort of cosmopolitan project is already there, sort of by default in a way. I mean, it doesn't matter that Pascal and Fermat and Mersenne and these mathematicians and scientists he's talking to are French. It's just simply not an issue. What's interesting is that they have interesting problems, and Huygens can begin to think about solutions. And so they set up this kind of, it's only a short trip to Paris at this time that he makes, and when he goes home, they send letters back and forth with these mathematical conundrums in them to be solved as sort of entertainments almost. And yeah, the fact that they're French or Dutch doesn't enter into it.
Yeah, it's nice that you quoted from that letter. I'm not sure if this is the same one I've got in front of me, but he talks about the beautiful and magnificent things we've seen in one of his early letters. It's that immediacy of the new experience that he's having. Was he a character, just based on your reading and spending time on him during the writing of the biography, do you find that he was gregarious as a scientist? He liked being in sociable circles and being set problems, or having, you know, the cut and thrust of people around him? Or should we imagine him as a bit happier at home with his telescope in seclusion, staring at Saturn?
I think he was, this is what's interesting about Paris, is that in Paris, he is very much involved in the social scene. And he's at the salons, and he's going to musical evenings, and he's going out to the races and out to visit posh country houses and this court and that court. He's going to anatomy demonstrations, all sorts of things, you know, that are entertaining, instructive, socially connected. Whereas when he's back in The Hague, which he does sort of retreat there once or twice for illness and to actually get on and do some writing up some of his treatises, he's much more sort of sulky and withdrawn, and there simply isn't that scene in Holland at that time. That's, you know, the excitement of Paris, the glitter of Paris is there for him, and he immerses himself in that.
And at this moment in July of 1655, we worked out, what was it, 4 months after our beginning, when he was sat with the telescope looking at Saturn, has the news of this discovery percolated through the minds of the great thinkers of Europe at this point?
He is known as the discoverer of Saturn's moon, And the question of what the ring is still a mystery. So he's discussing what it might be with French astronomers before actually he goes home and uses his better telescope and discovers what it actually is. But mainly it's a mathematical trip. And so Pascal and Fermat, these well-known mathematicians, are beginning to devise the field of probability, how to calculate chance, which is a matter of huge importance, not just because of there's a huge industry of gaming tables in Paris, but also later on for insurance and so on. Huygens gets very involved in that and shows his superior ability at solving those sorts of problems, and soon after writes the first textbook of probability, which is called Van Reckoning in Spelen van Geluk, which means the calculation of games of chance.
Is that last word look, did you say?
Geluk, okay. Yes.
Chance. Well, he eventually settled in Paris in 1663, you're right, and he lived there until 1681. Was this going to be the happiest years of his life? Or when you think of him in the best context, is it him at Paris, do you think?
I think so, yes. I mean, he was certainly most engaged with the world and other people at those times. And he becomes, in effect, the director of the program, or the founder, almost, of the French Academy of Sciences, which is a remarkable achievement for a Dutchman.
Equivalent to our Royal Society, more or less, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. I mean, he also becomes the first foreign fellow of the Royal Society. But he was instrumental in setting up the French Academy, which is incredible.
It seems almost beyond the point to mention Newton, because the whole point of, I suppose, writing was to bring him out from behind that great shadow. But was there, my curiosity won't let me leave this, was there a relationship between the two of friendship or respect, or were they strangers to one another?
No, there was a relationship later on. Newton, you know, as you know, was a difficult character and squabbled with many people, with many British scientists and astronomers and so on. But Huygens was a person he could turn to, who, you know, he respected his opinion. So his views on Newton's science were some of the few views that Newton would be inclined to read. And, you know, he did offer comments on the Principia Mathematica when Newton published that in 1686 or 1687. So they do then meet, and they meet under rather strange circumstances, which actually show very much that Huygens is the senior figure at this point. And it's at Hampton Court, and it's in 1649, so it's the year after the Glorious Revolution. And William III has invaded England, landing at Torbay with his big fleet that's four times the size of the Armada, and marching up through the West Country to London. And with him as his secretary, he has Constantine Huygens the Younger, Christian's brother. And so this scene at Hampton Court, we have William III and Constantine as the king's secretary, and Christian and Newton. And Newton has come to petition the king. It's necessary to petition the king for what he wants. And in addition to being by then, you know, a renowned natural philosopher, having recently published the Principia Mathematica, and a fellow of Trinity College and an MP for Cambridge. Anyway, he wants to be the provost of King's College. And it's through the Huygens brothers' good offices that he is able to access the king. So, you know, it shows, as I say, Newton very much the sort of junior partner in that relationship at that point. He doesn't get the provostship, and is sort of the fellows don't buy it on some technical point, and it never happens. But they did become friends, in as much as you probably could become friends with Newton, and they did spend a certain amount of time together, and they contributed to each other's scientific ideas.
Okay, we've got to get back to 2020 now, but before we do head back, I want to offer you the opportunity to pick up one tangible memento of your journey back to 1655. If you could just grab one thing, what would you like to have?
Well, this object may or may not have quite existed in 1655 because no working example survives. But it's a magic lantern. And it's another of Christian's inventions, or supposed inventions. There are diagrams of it, but as I say, no working example. And there's some doubt as to whether it really was much more than a theoretical concept. But essentially, it's an early slide projector. And it has a light source and lenses and a screen, and a screen to project an image on, and a layer where there is a transparency of some sort to project from. So, like the slide, there are actually some rather fantastic drawings made by Huygens that are modelled after Holbein, Dance of Death or Triumph of Death, I can't remember what it's called. And so there are these dancing skeletons, and he made these sort of slides, presumably etching small discs of glass or something, with these dancing skeletons to project, to demonstrate the capability of this magic lantern. So it shows the centrality of optics in Dutch life, this fantastic skill they've built up of making, you know, first spectacles and telescopes, and now new and cameras obscura for painters to use and so on. And now this magic lantern that actually has its own illumination source. And it's a sort of typical invention of Huygens's in a sense, that it, you know, centers on his areas of interest. It's an optical device, but it's also something for which it seems he could find no real use for it. But his father was completely charmed by the thing, and every time Huygens went home, his father seems to have wanted a sort of demonstration of this.
Well, I'm not surprised. Well, we'll let you have that as long as I can come and have a look at it. That'd be probably the rules. It'd be, and maybe it's a nice way of actually characterizing our conversation today. We could put three different vignettes into the magic lantern, one of the march moments, and or two of the march moments, and one of that entry into Paris. It's been a really, really enlightening conversation about a really fascinating character who we have missed out, but people have the opportunity, of course, to learn much, much more in the book. So I'll direct them that way. Thank you very much, Hugh Aldersley-Williams.
Thank you.
That was me, Peter Moore, talking to Hugh Aldersley-Williams about his new book, Dutch Light, Christian Huygens and the Making of Science in Europe. It's out just now in hardback, and it's a fascinating blend of storytelling and scholarship, and of course, really recommended by us. To find out more about the characters and the scenes featured in this week's episode, please do head over to our website at tttpodcast.com. There you'll find Hugh's trip to 1655, neatly situated in our timeline between Professor Simon Schaffer's episode on Isaac Newton and Dermot McCulloch's on Thomas Cromwell. We'll be back with another adventure into the past next Tuesday, but from me, for now, that's it. Thank you very much for listening.